Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have Prof. CJ from Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast. You can find him on profcj.org, profcj.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and he's also got his podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Please check him out. He's got some really awesome content, history that you definitely were not taught in government school. I want to get into some of the episodes that I heard of his that really really impressed me. One of them was his conversation with Daniele Bolelli, which I never heard of the guy before, but is a great conversation on Taoism. And Lao Tzu and things like that. And then he did a great series on the Revolutionary War, five-part series, and then Shay's Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion, all fascinating topics to get into. So Prof. CJ, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Hey, welcome. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I heard about you. Actually, Dave from the Cities of Liberty, I think he contacted you first, right? And we had you on there, and I'm like, wow, this guy, I gotta get this guy on my show. Really, really fascinating person, you know. You know, you don't find too many, anarchist historians, you know. I mean, I guess Murray Rothbard would be considered one, right?
Yeah, Tom Woods.
Tom Woods, right. But it's really great, and I think it was you that said on the Seeds of Liberty that you said you don't understand how some people can critically analyze history and not become an anarchist. Did you you said that, right?
Yeah. I guess it's because that's how I eventually came to this conclusion. Is I just spent so many years studying history, and I was not an anarchist when I started studying history. And I kind of gradually moved closer and closer to that position until I finally just sort of surrendered to it. But I mean, my path to it led right through years and years and years of studying history, and I still don't understand. I understand in a way, intellectually, I understand how people can choose to cling to beliefs that don't make sense. You know, there's lots of science that explains how this works and, you know, some of the things in the human brain that make it do this, but still at the end of the day, it's like, man, if you study history and it's just, you know, one atrocity after another, one jerk in power ruining things after another, you would think more people would eventually come to the conclusion of maybe we shouldn't have rulers.
Well, I think people look at history and they're like, wow, that must have been brutal, you know, wicked times. Thank God we live in the modern age when we're all civilized.
Sure.
And that doesn't happen anymore, right?
Yeah, they're doing great work over in Syria, I hear,
right,
to make history come back.
Yeah, pleasantly overlook the atrocities that are committed in the name of government, right? Those aren't considered murder, right? It's just war. It's just, you know, collateral damage, right?
Yeah, and one of the ways that you get this, and this is, I think, holds true even looking way back at ancient history, is a lot of the times just certain people are left out of the story, and usually those are like average people who are just, you know, trying to raise their family and take care of their farm or whatever, and you hear about, oh, Alexander the Great's doing this, and Genghis Khan's doing that, and Julius Caesar's doing this, and, like, you don't hear about, you know, the 99% of people who are just getting crushed, who are just pawns in their games. And, man, when you start to just even think about that, you realize a lot of these people that we're told are great are monsters. They're absolute monsters.
Yeah. Yeah, the word great, like you said, Alexander the Great is more probably like Alexander the evil or the wicked.
Oh, yeah, the psychopathic control freak, you know.
Right.
Give him whatever label you want, but, you know, great, I do not think it means what you think it means.
Exactly. So before we get into those topics, can you delve into a little bit of your past and how you got to anarchism and voluntarism, and you know how was your path and the things that you studied?
Yeah, well, basically, I came from a predominantly right wing family. Some of them more right wing than others, but there, other than a few maverick weirdos who are lefties, it's mostly, you know, staunch Republicans and whatever in my family. And I grew up with that, so, you know, everybody just gets buried with whatever they're raised with. But even as a teenager, I was already starting to realize that there were problems with this. Probably one of the first things that I started to think was BS was the war on drugs. I started to just look at the war on drugs, and it made no sense to me that you would, you know, throw somebody in prison just because they want to use a substance that, you know, some other people don't think they should use. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of like the little opening, you know, crack in the basic, you know, mindset I was raised with. And then when I was in college was when 9/11 happened and the war on terror and all that. And at first when it happened, I was kind of swept up in the, oh man, we gotta, you know, get these guys and whatever. But it didn't take long observing how everything went down and how, you know, the government just went so crazy, with the Patriot Act and then with invading countries like Iraq that clearly had nothing at all to do with the attacks and how bad that whole thing went, that I kind of threw out my attachment to the right and sort of became kind of a mild Gary Johnson libertarian, sort of a, you know, for lack of a better term. And then it was just a matter of probably 4 or 5 years of reading increasingly radical stuff. And I never had the moment where I never had the one eureka moment where I said, "Oh, that's it. I've given up on the state entirely." It was a gradual process. It took years and lots of reading, lots of learning, and just somewhere along the way, I just sort of shed those beliefs and just said, "I just can't, you know, do this anymore. I can't believe these things anymore." So yeah, and history was a huge part of it, probably the major part.
Yeah, you know what stood out to me when you were saying that is how you said it took many you know, books and reading and articles and maybe I don't know if you, did any YouTube personalities or podcasters affect you in your development?
I definitely had podcasts I listened to, although I think by the time I started getting big into podcasts, I was already most of the way there.
Okay.
So
yeah. So one of the things I observe is that, you know, most anarchists and voluntarists are extremely well read, you know, and as compared to their you know, Democratic or Republican counterparts who function most
on
emotions and all that.
Yeah, I'd be interested if anybody did a study of IQ versus, you know, the degree of statism. Is there a correlation there? Because you don't meet very many anarchists who are just dumb, you know, who are not intelligent and who are not at least relatively well read, you know, compared to the general average person. Meanwhile, there's just a lot of dumb statists out there. Now, it's not to say that they're beyond hope, because of course,
right,
I was one. I don't know if I'm guessing you were at some point back in your past a statist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I try to remind myself of that, like, it did take me a bunch of years to give up on what I was inculcated with. So it's one of those things, you know, we all tend to fall prey to the whole so much smarter than everybody else. And, you know, I do it too, but then I think I was one of those people for a while, you know? So,
yeah. Yeah. I think it was a Malcolm X quote. He says, you know, you shouldn't be quick to condemn other people for the things they didn't know, because there was a time when you didn't know what you now know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if you went back enough years, I'd be the dunce going, "But what about the roads?"
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my past, I came from a Democrat family, and so, you know, they support any Democrat candidate or president. But the thing is, I wasn't really intensely passionate about politics for the most part. I really was indifferent to politics. Mm. I didn't care about it. You know, I was into you know, chess and piano, philosophy, Eastern philosophy, Western philosophy, Taoism, and then alternative medicine, things like that, Eastern nutrition. And then, slowly I got interested in nutrition, and I learned about, you know, the corruption with the, you know, FDA and Monsanto, you know, big pharma, all that kind of stuff, and vaccines. And slowly you begin to, you know, examine, you know, well, if the pharmaceutical company is corrupt because it has, you know, ties with government, with, you know, with lobbyists and with subsidies and favoritism, then what about everything else? What about the big banks? What about, you know, everything else, special interest groups? So I kind of got into it like that, and I didn't really care about voting, although I did vote for Obama because my mother was a Democrat. She's like, vote for Obama. So I voted for Obama. Didn't really know what I was doing, but, you know. So I always say that, like, in my last time voting was 2008, and you know, that's it. You know, you make mistakes in your past, and you know, you learn from your mistakes, and you try not to repeat them. So I think that's what we can.
Yeah. I mean, I try to, you know, just always, whenever I catch myself, like, you know, getting the attitude of disdain towards people, I think, well, some of them are beyond hope, but you know, you never know. And I've had some surprises. You know, I've had some people that I thought would never, you know, get better ideas, and did, and, you know, I don't know if I should take credit for any of those or what, but sometimes people do surprise you.
Yeah, I do get the feeling when I listen to your podcast that you are, you know, you're a patient person, and that you're very well articulate person, and so I think that in itself makes your philosophy attractive, right, to people. If they feel like, you know, you're a calm person, you're not going to attack them for being, you know, having a different opinion, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it comes from what I've been doing for almost 10 years now, which is teaching history to primarily 18, 19-year-olds, most of whom don't really want to be there because they're just taking the class because it's punching out a gen ed credit. You know, the vast majority of people coming through my classes are not history majors. Not that many of them are particularly interested in history, in part because they probably had nothing but terrible history classes throughout grade school. And so, you know, I've got to deal with that. And the way I think of it, and maybe I'm just, you know, trying to make myself seem a lot cooler than I am, but it's sort of like when the Beatles were in Hamburg, right? And the Beatles, I think they were playing at like a bar or a strip club or something in Hamburg, and they had to play like every night of the week to, you know, hard-drinking German audiences who weren't necessarily there primarily for the music. And, you know, whenever you hear the Beatles talking about how they got to be such a successful band, they always talk about the Hamburg experience, how it was grueling, but it forced them to have to, you know, perform. It forced them to have to to deal with it. And so, you know, that's probably shaped my approach and how I deal with things. I've got to keep my patience, even when students occasionally say something that's just incredibly, incredibly dumb or whatever. You know, just develop the way to kind of tease it out and maybe Socratically kind of get them to realize that their idea has flaws.
So can you give me an example of a quote dumb thing that a student has said to you?
No, I don't have one handy. There hasn't been one in a while.
Okay,
honestly.
I guess that's good then.
Yeah. There's been a, well, there was this one. Yeah, this is one that made me kind of despair about the future for a while. I actually did have a student one time, and this was a long time ago. This was towards the beginning of when I started teaching. I had a student that were covering World War II, and I started to talk about Japan. And no joke, student raises her hand and asks me, "What does Japan have to do with World War II?" How you got to be 19 years old and in college, which means somebody somewhere must have thought you were worthy of a high school diploma.
Right.
And I understand not everyone's an expert in World War II, but, like, you would at least know Japan was in it.
Right. You know, the other thing that I was listening to your Danelli Bolelli interview, and one thing he was saying, or maybe, I'm not sure if you said this also, but how, you know, history, it can be a fascinating thing to learn about. You know, it's like, it's really exciting. It's like better than a movie if you have the patience to read and actually, you know, analyze what's going on. It's a really fascinating thing. But then there are also some people who can make it so extremely mind numbing,
yeah,
and boring that you want to kill yourself.
Yeah, that, and that's a lot of the formal academia, unfortunately. And think about some of the most popular stories in modern times, right? Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, The Sopranos. I mean, just think of any, and these are complex stories, and yet they have millions of fans who like know every detail and who just, you know, lap it up and I'm fans of a lot of those things that I just said, but the fact that there aren't as many people who are avid fans of history is not the fault of history, because it is a bunch of stories that are just as interesting and violent and dramatic and tragic and sometimes comic as any of those movies or works of literature or whatever. And the fact that not as many people are interested in history just shows that it's oftentimes not told in a very interesting fashion. You know, they pick the most boring stuff to zero in on in a lot of academic history. Not that I think we should always be choosing what we look into just based on what's interesting, but I mean, at a certain point, if what you're teaching and sharing with your students and what you're writing articles and books about isn't interesting, why are you doing it?
You know? Right. It's like, do I even have to ask that question?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it comes down to some people just find things interesting that 99% of the rest of the world thinks are boring, but
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, another thing that came to mind is, you know, Stefan Molyneux has this series, The Truth About, right? And he picks various people and he just, you know, goes through their entire lives. And, you know, he's done like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, you know, some fascinating people. And one of the common themes of that, which I really like, is the fact that he really tries to discourage hero worship, right? Which it seems like they do a lot in government school. You know, there are certain people that are just untouchable, right? That are just impeccable people that we must idolize, right? Because they wrote on a piece of paper, "I am your ruler, and you must pay taxes to me," right?
Yeah. Or because they killed enough people somewhere along the line.
Right. I mean,
generally, in those polls and whatever that rank the presidents, the ones that are ranked the greatest usually are the ones with the highest body count.
Right.
And the ones that are ranked, you know, mediocre or even bad are the ones who didn't get that many people killed, you know? I mean, everybody reviles Warren Harding and considers Calvin Coolidge mediocre. You know, I don't think these are necessarily good guys, but compared to people who bomb millions of innocent villagers to death in some third world country, I'll take a lovable buffoon like Warren Harding any day.
Yeah. I mean, Abraham Lincoln is major idol worship in many people's eyes. And then you have like even, you know, now with Obama, so people are like, what, you know, when Obama was elected, and you know, most of the black population are like, yes, victory, we have a black man.
Sure.
You know, as if you know, things are going to change because he's black, right? The pigment of his skin, or it's like, I feel like that, you know, Hillary has a big chance of winning just so the women can say, yes, finally a victory.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And nothing substantive ever seems to really change, at least not in a good way.
No, definitely not. I mean, things, progressively get worse. So why don't you, can you tell us a little bit about, let's go into some of the rebellions, because, I mean, the Revolutionary War is fascinating, but it's really complex, you know,
yeah.
Area. But what's fascinating is even afterwards, so, you know, the revolution is over, and although, actually, can you go into a little bit of you did an episode on why you didn't think it might not have been considered it could not have been considered a revolution, right? There are many factors for that.
Yeah. This is something that actually is one of the arguments that academic historians have that I do think is at least kind of interesting, which is the American Revolution really a revolution when you compare it to the other political revolutions in history, like the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, you know, that seem more violent and dramatic, where there's huge upending of society, where, I mean, there's completely a disconnect between what came before and what came after. And some people point to the American Revolution and say, it's not really that much of a revolution. It's just simply a secession or an independence war.
Mm.
And, you know, beyond that, there's not much change. And then there are people who say, no, it definitely was a revolution. There's just, you know, various factors why it never turned quite as violent as the French Revolution, let alone the Russian Revolution. And, you know, where I came down on it, because I had a few spots in my Revolution series where I talked about that question, is basically kind of that it was a revolution, but it was not a complete revolution. Like that it didn't quite live up to the potential that it had. And there's a variety of reasons for this, and part of it is because the pro-independence faction was never unified on what exactly the revolution was supposed to be for. There was the more kind of conservative group who simply wanted to kick out the British and have a homegrown American elite essentially running a system very similar to what the British ran, with mercantilism and a very powerful central government and all this sort of thing, and just kind of give it a veneer of republicanism, you know, call the guy a president instead of a king.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the faction of people like George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris, these sorts of characters. And then there were the ones who certainly were flawed from you know, our perspective, but were better. The sort of Thomas Jefferson crowd, the more, by the standards of the time, the more radical, the more kind of libertarian-ish, who thought, you know, the revolution isn't just about changing, exchanging some British oppressors for some American oppressors. That it was supposed to be about something more significant than that, really about, you know, trying to liberate the individual. And unfortunately, for the most part in the long term, the Washington, Robert Morris, Hamilton faction basically won. They did have periodic setbacks over the years, but in the long term of American history, they did win.
Yeah, and I guess Patrick Henry would be considered with Thomas Jefferson, right? With that.
Yeah, for the most part, I think, and I have to say, I'm not quite as familiar with him as I am with some of the others.
Okay.
With his sort of post-war career, I think towards the end of his political career, he became a bit more of the conservative type, and had a little bit more sympathy with the Federalist. I could be wrong about that, but. That's just my recollection. But certainly, at the time of the Revolutionary War, he was one of those radicals. He was one of those people that really thought the revolution was supposed to be about something besides just the zip code of who's collecting your taxes.
Yeah, and also what really impressed me was when you were mentioning how the people, you know, what various groups of people, how their lives were affected before the revolution and afterwards.
Yeah.
And how most people had no change or were worse off
yeah.
after the revolution.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of people were. And, you know, this is one of the insights. I give credit to some of the new left historians, people like Howard Zinn and William Appleman Williams and others. And I did an episode a long time ago about three leftist historians that every libertarian ought to read. And, you know, just because we wouldn't necessarily agree with them on everything and we wouldn't agree with them on, you know, their prescriptions for economic policies, doesn't mean they're not dead on right about some things and doesn't mean they don't have lots of important insights to offer. Murray Rothbard was a fan of a lot of these new left historians. And, you know, kind of like what I was saying before about, you look back at Alexander the Great and only look at the rulers, he looks like this great guy doing all these wonderful things, and you look at the perspective of the average person, the small farmer, the slave, just the sort of random citizen, and it's a little bit more complicated. Well, same thing with the American Revolution. If you bother to look at the situation for slaves, the situation for Native Americans, and so on. It's really problematic. And even some of the poor white folks, you know, on the frontier in a lot of areas were worse off after the revolution than they were before.
Yeah, right. And I guess that leads into the Shays Rebellion. It happened before, right? Before the Whiskey Rebellion?
Yeah, Shays Rebellion was first. Shays Rebellion was actually before the writing of the Constitution.
Oh.
When the country was still governed by the Articles of Confederation. And it was basically in western frontier counties of Massachusetts. And you had a lot of people there who were war veterans, who were in bad economic situations, largely not their own fault, largely because of their military service.
Yeah.
And a lot of them had ended up in debt. And then the state government of Massachusetts instituted a bunch of policies that, in a variety of ways, made things even more difficult for those people.
Hmm.
And that privileged a lot of the eastern elites in the big cities like Boston. And so you had a lot of people who had real serious grievances. These were not, you know, just lazy people sitting around saying, give me bailouts and give me welfare. These were, you know, veterans of the revolution, hardworking farmers in the frontier. And they tried to work through the system, and they tried to get certain reforms they thought might help them. But the state government in Boston was totally rigged against them. And the governor was very hostile to them. And so eventually a group of these people rose up in rebellion, starting off not really violent, kind of shutting down courthouses and things like that, not really, you know, going out and sniping people.
Mm.
But then it started to escalate, and eventually the governor sent in a massive military force, and there were a few little battles and things. And the rebellion fizzled out. And unfortunately, a lot of the rebels were not very well armed, and because they were so broke, you know, Daniel Shays himself, who was one of the leaders of the rebellion, who had been a Revolutionary War captain, was so broke right after the war. A lot of these guys served in the war for like 5 years and hardly ever got paid the whole time.
Yeah, didn't they get paid in bonds, right? Just
basically
like the Continentals.
I think they got paid in Continentals for a while, and then the Congress eventually stopped printing them because the inflation was so bad.
Yeah.
And then they were basically given them IOUs, kind of like a weird form of a bond that wasn't like a normal bond where somebody actually like lent the government money, which is sort of the government printed an IOU.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these guys were so desperate during and after the war that they traded those for like pennies on the dollar because nobody thought they were worth anything.
Mm.
And then most of these end up in the hands of wealthy speculators who then get the ear of the state, and basically the state comes in and says, okay, we're going to make those things get paid. We're going to, you know, collect the taxes.
Mm.
And so in a lot of cases, the very speculator that you know, bought your bond for pennies on the dollar now is demanding it get paid full face value with interest by taxing you, and also is the same guy who, if you go totally broke and lose your farm, is going to swoop in and buy your farm at a fire sale price.
Mm.
Now, you could see to like a hardened combat veteran that, I mean, we've seen the Rambo movies, right? I mean, you can only push you can only screw angry veterans so much until you're playing with fire. And that was Daniel Shays and a lot of these people who joined him. And they put him down brutally. One of the things that surprised me when I first came across it was Samuel Adams, who we normally think of as being part of the sort of radical revolutionary faction. And he certainly was during the war against the British. But then once independence was done, he became a big-time statist, specifically for the state of Massachusetts. He was kind of an anti-federalist when it came to the federal government, but he thought, you know, I'm a citizen of the Republic of Massachusetts, and it's one thing to disobey the laws of a monarchy, that's good, but to disobey a republic is evil.
Mm.
He was calling for all sorts of horrific punishments and the death penalty and everything for all the rebels.
Mm.
He literally drafted a riot act that had all these punishments for anybody who was joining in the rebellion. So he's a great example of somebody who, you know, in one instance is this great, you know, hero for liberty, and then all of a sudden the next day is a complete cheerleader for the state. And Lou from Freedom Fiends, I don't know if you know Lou.
Lou Fiend, yeah.
Okay, yeah. He put it really funny to me once. He said, you should do a Dangerous History Frenemies on Samuel Adams, right? DHP Frenemies.
Nice.
And a good guy one day, bad guy the next.
Right. Wow, amazing. Huh? Yeah. I remember learning about when I started, you know, learning about Austrian economics. I read the book Creature from Jekyll Island, right? J. Edward Griffin, and I learned an amazing amount of stuff from that on history, and also a couple of documentaries. But yeah, referencing how, you know, gold and silver is in the original Constitution, and how, you know, the not worth a continental, that phrase, you know, originated at that time period, and how the reason why they put gold and silver in the Constitution was because they were so afraid of hyperinflation. They knew the dangers of paper money at that time of fiat currency, and so they were, I guess, able to stave it off for a few decades. When and then it came back, I think, during Lincoln's time, right? The War of Northern Aggression.
Well,
with the greenbacks?
Yeah, that was the next time there was a lot of paper money.
Right.
And, you know, some of the anti-Federal Reserve crowd, I'm sure you've run into this, mm-hmm. Some of the anti-Federal Reserve crowd love the greenbacks.
The resource-based economy people, you know, they talk about how Lincoln did the greenbacks, and it was wonderful because the government controlled it.
Yeah, and sort of like the Lyndon LaRouche type people.
Yeah.
You know, or some of the people that go a bit further than I'm willing to be comfortable with some of the conspiracy theories. Like, you know, I'm in an awkward place because I'm a moderate conspiracy theorist, you know, which is a tough place to be in, uh-huh. Right? Because on the one hand, you know, you think the mainstream is full of it, but on the other hand, there's all these people that, you know, go to crazy town on the conspiracies, and I'm awkwardly in the middle, like, well, some of these are kind of true, but a lot of them aren't true, and, you know, some of them are sort of true, but you go like 10 steps too far over the rainbow. You know,
yeah,
there's a lot of people like that out there.
Yeah, like I remember reading about the reptilian you know, shapeshifters, and then like even chemtrails. I mean the way I look at it is, like, we have enough wickedness and evil and predation and violence that we know about that is done out in the open and victimizing, you know, of innocent people, that it's not necessary to make up all of these stories. Like, then you got to research your facts and, you know, where are you getting your information from? And, you know, it's just not necessary. You know, we know what the incentives are of having power, of having, you know, a secured income through taxation, right, through the theft of taxation. We know that that perverts incentives. There's no need to conjure up more ghosts and demons to be angry about it.
Yeah, which is why in my podcast I try to stick to the ones that, like, there's no question in terms of conspiracies. And when I don't have total proof, I admit that. I say, you know, I'm kind of suspicious about this and that. This, you know, thing over here makes me wonder. But on the other hand, like, to me, the burden of proof for a really elaborate conspiracy should be pretty high, you know. So I'm willing to deal with things like MKUltra because we know it's real. Mm. I'm willing to deal with things like the radiation experiments done on unwitting American participants in the early Cold War, because those are real. Those are, you know, like, we have ironclad proof for all that stuff. You don't need to have shape-shifting lizard Rothschild people, you know, performing magic that actually works, in order to have some pretty nasty things being done by the people in power.
Right. I mean, I always tell people that we have more in common with the average Iraqi and Afghan person than we have with our own political masters, you know, and they don't have to be lizards for us to recognize that they're different. You know, sociopaths, you know.
Yeah. I think definitely there's higher rates of sociopathy among politicians, and the higher they are up the totem pole, the higher the rates probably are. And, you know, if somebody wants to say the reptilian thing is a metaphor, and, you know, I don't want to get on this rabbit hole too much, but if somebody wants to say it's just a metaphor, then I think that's fine, but right. But that's not how some people present it and talk about it, you
right,
know?
Right.
And every now and then I'll get an email or something about somebody asking me to cover something that, you know, I just have to kind of politely say, like, yeah, no, because it's something that I either already know is false, or I look at it and I go for a minute like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and 15 minutes of research and I'm just, no way. I mean, it's just outlandish. So, yeah, some of the greenback crowd are sort of that way. You know, they're the people who are correct in the Federal Reserve being bad, mm-hmm. And being the result of essentially a bankster conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But then a lot of them, their solution is like, yeah, so if we just had Congress printing up paper money at will, that would be great. Which,
right, right.
That's out of the frying pan into the fire, maybe.
I mean, even the word conspiracy, you know, I tell people, like, what is the definition of the word conspiracy? It's a couple of people getting together and planning something, right? So when I see a commercial, you know, on YouTube or on TV, that's a conspiracy to get me, a couple of people getting together, making something to have, you know, so I can believe or alter my perception, right? Or, yeah, when you get together with your friends, you conspire to get together. But it has this negative connotation. So, yeah, and then the other thing is, like you said, if it's true, it's not a conspiracy. It's just truth, right?
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, some of the more goofy out there conspiracy theory stuff, I wonder how many of the people who are pushing that stuff are just like working for the government in one way or another.
Right.
Like, you know, are they COINTELPRO basically out there to put out this ridiculous stuff to discredit by association mm-hmm. people who are actually raising legitimate questions and are sticking to what the evidence actually shows. And, mm-hmm. you know, because you think about it from the government's perspective, and there's some writings by, who the heck was the, Obama's information czar. What the heck's his name? He's a professor at like Harvard or someplace.
Oh yeah.
I'm blanking out on the guy's name. He actually wrote a paper, like published in academic journals back before Obama was president, essentially saying that the government should discredit conspiracy theorists by basically putting out its own conspiracy theories that were so ridiculous that they would discredit anybody who raised any questions about the official narrative of anything. And, you know, sometimes you got to wonder, because you can certainly understand how from their perspective, it would be great to be able to discredit anybody, to smear anybody mm-hmm. who raises any serious questions about, you know, the system or the official stories of any of the wars or things like that. It'd be great to just, you know, say they're all crazy tinfoil hat people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, so, it kind of reminds me of Edward Bernays, I think, wrote the book, right, Propaganda? And that was actually, it was picked up and read by Joseph Goebbels from the Minister of Propaganda.
right.
And how that's used to alter perception. And it's so true, you know, like, you know, it's not unrealistic to think that, that there would be, you know, I guess undercover agents or trolls online, you know, under various posts and trying to, you know, put in dubious remarks.
We know they've done it before. You know, COINTELPRO mm-hmm. eventually got out all that stuff where they were infiltrating groups back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And there was something that came out not that long ago, I think within the past year or two, mm-hmm. Where, and I don't remember if it was the Snowden leaks that showed this or what, but something came out that showed that the Pentagon was actually hiring people to set up phony social media accounts and basically go on there and troll. Like, that's your tax,
right.
your tax
right.
dollars at work
right.
are trolling people who are, mm-hmm. you know, questioning the official narrative. And in some cases, I think it was people who were pretending like they were, you know, conspiracy theorists or whatever, and just doing ridiculous stuff mm-hmm. To discredit somebody else who maybe was not as over the rainbow crazy in their theories. Just get them guilt by association.
Right. So let me ask you. So I haven't listened to many episodes, but I get the feeling that many of your episodes are on U.S. history, right? I think you do,
yeah.
Right? You do have other, from other countries. Because one thing that I was really interested in that I read a lot about, because I'm half Peruvian, half Australian, right? So so I was really fascinated with Inca culture, right? And the Inca Empire and the history of that. And I read a book called The Last of the Incas. And it told, just told the story about how their rise, that empire was built, and how basically very similar to the Roman Empire, it gobbled up all these small tribes, and forcing them to, subjugating them and forcing them to learn the Quechua language, which was the Inca language at the time, and pay tribute to the Sapa Inca, the sun god king. Do you know any? Have you studied any of this history at all, or do you plan? Do you plan to do or have?
Yeah. I might cover some of that stuff, actually. I mean, I cover it not in enormous detail, but I do cover it in world history.
Okay.
The book you mentioned, I think, is one that actually is on my Amazon wish list.
Is it?
Right now. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's one that I've heard of and thought, oh, that's a good one. And of course, my Amazon wish list is
ever growing.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
The list of books to read, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things about my podcast is because of Amazon affiliate sales, I get some Amazon credit every month. People buy stuff from going through my links,
nice.
Which I hugely appreciate because basically it feeds my reading for the show. So, it allows me every month when I get that credit, I can buy another giant pile of history books that can then go into making future episodes. And, that book is actually one I've recently put in there. I'm a bit more familiar with the Aztecs than with the Incas, as of right now. But yeah, a lot of those, Native American empires are just fascinating because they completely blow holes in the stereotype that a lot of North Americans have that like all of the indigenous peoples of the New World were all these sort of peaceful hippie types, wanted to smoke peyote or take peyote and smoke the peace pipe
and be one
commune
with
nature. The great spirit. Yeah. They're just basically hippies,
Right.
And man, the Inca, the Aztecs, the Mayans, they completely destroy that stereotype. I mean, They're conquering their fellow Indians quite brutally,
right.
Sacrificing them by the truckload.
Yeah,
and it's it's another one of those interesting stories where you can see the intersection of power and ideas, where the ruler is not just saying obey me because I have a bunch of guys who will enforce my will. It's I've got that and I'm also whatever in communication with the gods, or I'm the incarnation of one of the gods, or what have you.
Right.
And that's always very interesting stuff to me. I always tend to approach it from a cynical point of view, and not to say that I don't think any of those rulers believe that stuff. I'm sure some of them really did believe it, but at a certain point, when you're looking at somebody's ideology, it gets. Sometimes it's like, really, you believe that? That's so convenient. That's so convenient to what you're trying to do here.
Right.
It's, Genghis Khan thought, the gods have given me the world to rule. Well, isn't that convenient? Happened to be you.
It's nice to be the king, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, like you said, shattering the hippie native myth is like, with the Incas, where they have the virgins of the sun and you know human sacrifice as well as the Aztecs, right? And I think in Peru in the Andes mountains they discovered well-preserved young virgin women's bodies, like really well-preserved, like the hair is still there. It's really amazing. It's just fascinating to learn about that stuff and how, there's these people, the Chasquis, which are the runners you know, like they would run like marathons frequently, like just getting fresh food from the, what was it, the Pacific Ocean, all the way up to Cusco, which is the capital of the Inca Empire, where the Sapa Inca was. So bringing him fresh fresh food,
yeah.
These relay runners, and they would be running, and they would know that they really ran long distances, because after examining their skeletons, they would notice how worn out their knees were. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, the Inca are so interesting. It's one of the reasons I've wanted to look into them more. One of the reasons I find them just so interesting and unusual is the logistics of where they were. Like, literally some of the most rugged mountains on planet Earth.
Right, yeah.
And they're running an empire in that. Like, that is, you don't find many empires that are in rugged mountains. Usually rugged mountains is where states kind of lose their grip a little bit, mm-hmm. you know. Like, if you read something like The Art of Not Being Governed by James Scott, you know, a lot of areas, the mountains is where the state can't, at least in pre-modern times, can't really exert a lot of control. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Incas were able to do it, and do it in real rugged mountains too.
Yeah.
And all the logistics of how they ran their empire and the food and everything. And, you know, they're one of the few empires that wasn't based on grain, that was based on potato, which is another thing that's, you know, just kind of different. I mean, most of the other, you know, pre-modern empires in the world are based on one or more forms of grain. It's actually an episode I'm working on the notes for still. I'm going to try and record it in the next few days. An episode I'm going to do called Grains and the State. Simply about the historical linkages between grains and the state and why states tend to like grains. They tend to institute policies that favor grains over other, you know, forms of food. Which, if you just look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture today, right? What are the crops they subsidize and encourage the most? It's wheat, it's corn, and it's soybeans, you know, which actually are, I think, a form of grain. Mm. So, yeah.
So could it be because it's easy to store, like it has long shelf life? Like,
yeah, that's part of it. There's a whole list of attributes. Just like how some substances function better as money than others just because of certain inherent attributes,
yeah.
Grain functions as, you know, state food. Yeah, part of it is the shelf life. Part of it is that it ties people down geographically, right? If you're growing rice or wheat or whatever, like, you're not mobile. Mm-hmm. And that makes you easier to keep track of. It makes you easier to tax, to you know, take information in the census and whatever. It makes it easy for the tax man to know where to look, right? Grains, you know, they usually all come to fruition at the same time. It's easy for the tax guy to show up and confiscate what he wants, whereas if you're, I don't know, a hunter-gatherer, or you're practicing a more kind of varied form of agriculture and that sort of thing, it's just a lot harder for them to keep track of you and to come take your stuff. If you're growing nothing but yucca plants, what are they going to do? Send an army of guys to literally dig up all the ground around where you are to find all of your yucca? I mean, right. Way more trouble than it's worth.
Right.
But if you've got a giant field of corn or something, it's pretty easy.
Well, fascinating, fascinating. Yeah, and another fascinating thing about the Incas I remember learning was that their system for recording population, you know, food stores, basically archives, I guess, historical archives, information, right? And they use this thing called the quipus. I think the way they translate it is Q-U-I-P-O. And it's because they didn't have a written system at all. It was this series of knots in rope. And it's a fascinating thing, because they were able to construct this elaborate way of transmitting information through these ropes, right? And, like, you know, depending on, you know, what kind of rope they're using, and then if they intertwine the rope with a different thing, like let's say intertwine it with sheep wool, then it would mean, you know, something pertaining to sheep, or, and then there's different knots and the length of, you know, how the knots, how intermittent they were, or how large or small they were, that transmitted different information. And so they would, you know, of course these chaskis would take, you know, they would run that, you know, back and forth, and this would be like the circulation networks, right? The USPS transmitting information. And oh my God. And so the one thing that that the Spaniards did to break down their level of communication was to destroy their stores of information, destroy that history. And so they would burn down these areas where they accumulated all these you know, system of ropes and knots. And that's one way they broke down their cohesion.
Right.
So really, really fascinating stuff. And I think I read that book like 2 or 3 times.
yeah. I'm looking forward to reading it. And those, I'm more familiar with just sort of the stories of the Spanish conquests of a lot of those groups.
Okay.
And I always just find it just interesting and complicated, because I can't figure out who to root for, because on the one hand, a lot of these people were pretty nasty, you know, imperial conquerors themselves.
Right. Yeah.
And then on the other hand, then in come the Spaniards like a bull in a china shop.
Right.
You know, messing things up and a lot of times putting a stop to some bad stuff, like the Spaniards typically put a stop to the practice of human sacrifice.
Yeah.
But then, you know, they did horrible things themselves, and they brought in diseases and, you know, destroyed cultures and created all this chaos and destruction.
Right.
I think
I think that goes back to the idea of, talking about World War II, right, and Hitler, and everybody, like, generally accepts the idea that Hitler was an evil guy, right? He's the embodiment of evil. He's the incarnation of evil. You can't get any more evil than Hitler.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how quickly people forget or discount the history of wicked acts in our own country perpetrated by our own government.
Sure. Right?
And they quickly jump over then, well, Hitler was more evil.
Yeah.
And it's not like that. It's not like, you know, a good versus evil. It's like this evil guy fights this evil guy.
Yeah.
And this evil guy has a little more firepower, so that's why he wins. But nobody's really good. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, exactly. And no one would accept those sorts of alibis in just sort of individual life. Like, if you were a serial killer who had maybe only killed 5 people, and then you got caught, like, no one would accept it as a valid legal defense if you went into court and said, listen, yeah, I've murdered 5 people, but who hasn't?
There's worse.
And secondly, I know dozens of guys who have killed 20, 30, 40 people, so, you know, really you should just give me a pat on the back and let me go. You know. No one would accept that, but when it comes to the rulers, then they have the Stockholm syndrome kicking in, and it turns into, well, you know, my ruler is marginally less of a criminal than the one over there, so therefore mine is good.
Right.
Know?
That reminds me of a Larkin Rose video. It's called "What's So Bad About the Nazis," and he poses. Did you see this one?
I have not. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, he posed a serious question. He's like, this is not a rhetorical question. What is so bad about the Nazis? What did the Nazis do that's really horrible? And then they're going like, well, they killed a bunch of people. All right. The Native American genocide, chain slavery, you know, internment of Japanese Americans, Italian Americans, German Americans. should I continue?
Yeah.
And it's like, what else? Well, they had an evil flag. Well, so the piece of fabric, that's what made them evil. Like, you can't really say what they did was more evil than us, because it's not true. or even talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? How many innocent people died with that?
Yeah. And also keep in mind, I mean, which country arguably did more of the job of beating Hitler than anyone else by far? It was Stalin's Soviet Union. You know, that the Red Army did like 80 to 90% of the work of actually crushing the German army in World War II. You know, any historian who's an expert on World War II, the European theater of war, will tell you that. And so, even if you want to make an argument that, like, okay, Hitler killed millions of people in a relatively short amount of time. That's just simply a larger magnitude than you know what was happening in the United States. Then you still have the problem of, okay, but the country that did more of the work of beating Hitler than anybody else was Stalin's Soviet Union, which like was equivalent to Nazi Germany in the magnitude of how many people they were killing in a short amount of time. You know, in the 30s is when Stalin was doing his purges and his show trials and was, you know, deliberately starving out Ukraine and, you know, all these things that are right there,
right, right.
In terms of size of the atrocities. But, you know, those were the years during World War II. That was when he was Uncle Joe. Right.
Right?
That was when, like, Time Magazine is saying he's a great guy and he likes to sing opera and he likes American novels and, you know.
Yeah, I think Hitler was also, right? Time Magazine, for 1 year?
Yeah, yeah, Man of the Year.
Right, Man of the Year.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, back in the late 30s.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a great documentary. I don't know if you checked it out. I think it's called The History of Gold. And it focused on, especially like in World War II, and what role did gold play in World War II, and which countries Hitler chose to invade, and why. And a lot of it was due to the fact that he was broke, right? And he needed money to fund his whatever he wanted to do. And I think his accountant, when his accountant told him, he's like, "Sir, we're broke." So he shot his accountant, and then he got a new one, and he got a new guy. And the guy's like, "Let's invade these countries. They have gold. Let's get their gold." And so he started invading. And I think by the time they got to France, like, France knew they were coming for the gold, so they hid the gold, scattered it in the countryside, and then eventually they started like putting like massive amount of gold bars on ships and shipping it to Canada and the United States, which was neutral at that time, right, in the war, and a lot of those ships got sunk by German U-boats. So much of this shipwreck gold lies still at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. have you seen this? Have you heard about this story?
No, I have not. No.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And there's actually a business that their main focus is to excavate and find these ships with these gold bars. And they only go for ships that have like something like $50 million because it's so expensive to do what they do,
right,
and dive so deep as they do that they need to be compensated.
Sure.
You know, for what they do. And that basically, I guess the same reason that the Roman Empire fell was, or one of the reasons was that with Hitler, that he overextended himself and he kept thinking, oh, I can invade this country, invade that country, invade that country. And then finally he gets to Russia and people just retreat into Siberia, right? And just like starve or just...
Yeah.
They couldn't stand the cold, right? Something like that?
Yeah, the cold and the sheer size and
right,
all that. I mean, you know, logistics are real.
Yeah.
I wish some of America's recent rulers would remember this and, you know, not do dumb stuff like start long-term major ground wars in Afghanistan, you know, places like this where you'd think if you had sort of passed World History 101, you would know there are just parts of the world that are a real pain in the ass to try to occupy and that imperialism never really works long-term. Because there's no example of an empire that's around today that's been around for, you know, centuries and centuries or millennia.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody thinks their empire is going to be different. Everybody thinks, oh yeah,
right,
no, ours is the one that's going to go on forever and just always be awesome and never go broke and never overextend itself and never fall apart. You know, the Romans thought that,
mm-hmm,
you know, everybody thinks that. Not that long ago, the British thought that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main thing I studied in grad school was British Empire. And I'm still thinking about, you know, in the future, maybe doing a massive, mini series on the centuries of history of the British Empire on my podcast, just to finally have some use for all that grad school learning I did. And, you know, the British, same deal. They thought they were special. They thought they were, you know, some form of basically a master race.
Mm.
Or at the very least that their civilization was superior.
Right.
And they thought, yeah, of course, you know, the sun never sets on the British Empire. It never will. And they all end up in the same place, you know. They all end up on the garbage can of history. But, you know, now the neocons think that America's just gonna be the internal empire.
Right. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer, but before we go, I just want to ask you, you know, what I ask everybody. Well, first of all, what's your one of your favorite quotes, like all-time favorite quotes?
I got a lot, but one of my favorites right now, I mean, you know, there's about 100 Mencken quotes, but one of my favorites right now is from Edward Abbey, the novelist and American anarchist of the 20th century, and the quote is something along the lines of, anarchism is not some high-minded idealism, but the hard-headed realization that we can't let our lives be run by priests, generals, kings, and county commissioners.
Right.
So, excellent. Yeah, I've got it on my office wall at work, so I could have quoted it exactly, but I don't have it here at home, so...
No worries. Excellent quote. I really love that one. So before we go, like if you had to, you know, talk to somebody and try to explain to them why you think knowing history is important to their life and relevant, why they should study it, what would you say to the person?
Yeah, that's a good question and one that people always sort of have, especially when they're told they have to take a history class whether they want to or not. Is, you know, when am I going to use this, right?
Like we all
said about calculus. But when it comes to history, I think it's not what a lot of people say is that you need to know history so that we can avoid the mistakes of the past. Okay? And of course, first question with that is, who's this we you're talking about, right? what's this, you know, fuzzy collective that you're talking about? Are you a king? Are you a president? You know, who are you to be saying we? I'm not a decision maker who's telling the state what to do.
Yeah.
But secondly, the reality is that decent people almost never find themselves in a position of real power. And other than occasionally by just complete accident, and that was more common in the days of monarchy, like you might accidentally get a prince who's a decent guy and then becomes king and like isn't that bad.
Mm.
But in general, the tendency is people who find themselves in positions of power tend to be just simply the most effective and ruthless psychopaths and sociopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hope that you're going to somehow learn history and either become a politician or get a politician's ear and persuade them to not do the stupid and evil things those people always tend to do, to me is just completely unrealistic. And so to me, the answer I would give is more along the lines of, stupid and evil people always tend to find their way into positions of power where they tend to do things that are stupid or evil or both. And, you know, other than maybe long term, trying to convince enough people to not want to be ruled and to actually want to be free, other than that long term project, in the short term, there's really no hope that that sort of thing isn't going to keep happening.
Mm.
You know, it's like living in a hurricane zone and thinking that, well, you know, we can just, somehow persuade hurricanes to not hit us. It's not going to happen, right? So if you live in a hurricane prone area and assuming for whatever reason you want to keep living there, you don't try to persuade the hurricanes to go away. You say, okay, this stuff is going to happen from time to time. And sort of what are just some rational things that I can do to try and, as much as possible, you know, protect myself and my family and kind of figure out how to accommodate myself to these forces the best I can so that I don't get steamrolled, right? And so to take an extreme example, admittedly an extreme example, but to illustrate the point, if you were a Jew in Germany in, I don't know, 1935, you would be wasting your time and probably throwing away your life if you said, well, I'm a German, this is my country, and I'm just going to stay here and try and work within the system and persuade my leaders to like Jews more or whatever, right?
Right.
The rational thing would be to get the hell out if at all possible, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's obviously an extreme case, but to illustrate the point that to me, history, above all else, is in a way a form of kind of self-defense, so that you can know what kind of stupid and evil crap they're likely to do. And, you know, you can't avoid all of the problems they're going to cause. Obviously, if our leaders decide to be stupid enough to, I don't know, try and start a war with Russia or something, that's going to have negative consequences that we probably can't all dodge.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are things that you can learn to help you empower yourself and protect yourself as much as possible that I don't think you could do if you were ignorant of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, intellectual self-defense, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and one way I like to look at history is, you know, people say that history repeats itself, but to add to that, it's like, you know, you change the names and change the faces and the costumes, but the storyline seems to repeat itself over and over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody, I think it might have been John Adams, who did occasionally say a brilliant thing every now and then, even though I typically don't like him. But I think it was John Adams who supposedly said, history is philosophy teaching by example. So that's another benefit, is it's sort of like, you know, if like me, you're too stupid to figure out, you know, proper ethics and things like the non-aggression principle simply in the realm of pure abstract philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't figure it out there. I figured it out by looking at history. And so history's philosophy teaching by example, I think is just another path,
mm-hmm.
just another path that works for some people, you know, to get them where, you know, you and I think anyway is the right place to be.
All right. Yeah, yeah, and just to finish off, for me, my favorite, I think one of my favorite history quotes is Napoleon Bonaparte. I think he said, "History is a pack of lies agreed upon." Right.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. It's pretty much, you know, what the people in power decide they want you to think,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of most mainstream history. Obviously, not the kind of stuff that I do on my show. I pretty much try to do the opposite.
Right, right, right. So before you go, please plug you know, all the ways people can reach you if they want to find your work.
Sure. My website is profcj.org, and you can also find my podcast on Stitcher, on iTunes. If you just put in Dangerous History Podcast, you'll probably find it. I am also on Twitter and Facebook as well. There's links to those on my website, or, you know, just go on Facebook and put Dangerous History Podcast or Prof. CJ or something like that, and you'll get it. And same thing with Twitter. I think on Twitter my handle is profcj.org, like spelled out, like D-O-T-O-R-G, at profcj.org, all spelled out in words.
Okay.
Just because that's what Twitter had available when I was setting it up.
Nice.
So.
Well, somebody took anyway. ProfCJ and the dot. Somebody took that from
yeah.
you? Oh, my God. You see that?
Yeah. I had to spell out the dot.
See that? Links you have to go to the
yeah, yeah. Well, it's the same reason my website is .org, because at the time I got it anyway, they didn't have .com available. So.
See that? And I'm sure he wasn't doing anything with his website, the .com guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, you know, probably some random jerk just, you know, squatting on it.
Well, awesome. Thank you very much, CJ, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Hey, sure. It was a pleasure.
So this is if you want to help out my show, please you can help me out through Patreon, Bitcoin, or PayPal. Please help me out. I love having fascinating guests like CJ here for enlightening conversations, and I really want to do more of it. And monetary compensation is always encouraged.
Yes.
Although I will continue to do it nevertheless, but my wife would be happy if I get a little compensation. So I'm sure you feel the same way, right?
Absolutely.
You still do it because it's a labor of love, though, right? Because you want to see a better world for your children and your grandchildren, right?
So, yes, but getting a little money helps.
Yes, definitely. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. This is Peace Find Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network, and thus ConsciousResistance.com and thus EaseOfLiberty.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.